I told you I'm very excited about this episode because I think it's something that most Americans need to know about, something, you know, we really didn't know about medicine. So joining me today is Dr. Meehan, and we're going to get into medicine, what's behind medicine, and why, how is he practicing today, and how is that different from when he first started as a doctor? So thank you, Dr. Meehan, for joining me today on the program.
Oh, it's great to be here, Amber.
I'm so excited because I think I've been waiting for a doctor just like you to get onto my program because COVID really opened my eyes to a lot of things. I was already questioning childhood vaccines, and COVID then solidified my belief system now on childhood vaccines. But then it showed me a lot of other things. It showed me how our regulatory agencies can lie to the American people. But even so, you know, doctors believed in the regulatory agencies, but now doctors are like, huh, should I really take advice from them? But going back, I've kind of got a gist of the history of where medicine started. Would you kind of share with us with like the modern day medicine we are experiencing today versus, you know, maybe before that, what's the difference?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can go way back, but let's face it. Let's start with today. And you're right. I think you're seeing what a lot of people are seeing is how much fraud, corruption, pseudoscience, regulatory capture, you know, it's fully occurred. When our FDA approved the childhood, the COVID vaccine for children,
right,
based on, you know, eight mice studies, inadequate studies. I mean, the entire COVID-19 pandemic has really exposed just how off the rails and broken medicine has become. We are too trusting of our federal agencies, the CDC. They're untrustable, and they've been that way for a long time, but it's only during the COVID pandemic that we've really, that the general public has become aware that, hey, something is really wrong here. And still a lot of people have not. But this has definitely been, you know, I think a part of God's plan was to show everybody just how evil and broken the system is, that we've been so reliant and kind of blindly trusting people in positions of authority to the point where we're doing things that, you know, conflict with our beliefs, that we're doing things that just don't make sense. And we have seen, you know, anti-science nonsense perpetrated on the general public. So that's the state of medicine today. And it's probably even worse than that. The other thing I would say is that our hospitals have become even more dangerous. The best doctors and the best nurses have left those broken systems a long time ago. The people, the doctors and the nurses, and, you know, this is not a blanket statement. I'm sure there's some good doctors and nurses there, but for the most part, they either got burned out from the horrors of the pandemic and the worst case scenarios and the sociopathic CEOs that run those institutions. And they're just big institutions that are just big industry. They don't care about the doctors and the nurses. They don't care about the patients. They care about the bottom line. But what you have today is, you know, what I would call scab physicians and nurses working in hospitals. They're the ones that didn't leave because they'll do anything that the hospital tells them to do. They'll prescribe a dangerous antiviral like remdesivir. They'll suppress your respiratory drive with midazolam and fentanyl. And they'll put you on a ventilator because they're incentivized to do that. And they know that's what's going to keep their job because they saw their colleagues run out of the hospital, terminated, coerced out of the hospital, you know, because they didn't want to get a vaccine or otherwise, get the COVID vaccine or otherwise. And they know that if they do the same thing that their colleagues did that said, I am not going to use a failed antiviral that's too dangerous to give to Ebola patients just because Anthony Fauci hand-walked it through the FDA emergency use authorization approval process. Because ladies and gentlemen, that's what happened. That drug never should have been approved, never should have been administered to a patient in the hospital, but it was because it was giving the hospital, the sociopathic hospital administration, the opportunity to make money hand over fist by from taxpayer funding of $13,000 incentivizing to just make up a diagnosis of COVID-19 or have a fake PCR test that said that they were positive. Now they get $13,000 bonus. They put them on a ventilator and they got another multiple tens of thousand dollar bonus. They're incentivizing a death protocol, and they're even incentivizing death. Every hospital gets an additional $17,000 payment from the PrEP and CARES Act when a patient dies in the hospital. So all of this incentivization of the deaths that were happening in hospital is just intolerable. You know, it's like Charles Munger said, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome. And that's exactly what we create in the hospital. They have every incentive to falsify a diagnosis. They have every incentive to do what the nurse in New York did, you know, when she exposed the fraud of Elmhurst Hospital in New York City, the center of the epidemic in New York in the early stages of the pandemic. She exposed that those hospitals were putting PCR negative, COVID negative patients on the same floor with COVID patients and waiting for them to contract the disease so that they could then diagnose COVID-19 and get those bonus payments.
Let me talk about the PCR test for just a second, because this is my understanding. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding a PCR test is like a big magnifying glass. It just makes this little molecule bigger, bigger, and bigger. And so you could find almost like anything is on this PCR test, that it's not a definitive, oh, this is what it, this is this disease, or this is that germ, or this is that cell. It's my understanding it's just a magnifying glass.
It's a magnifying glass and a copy machine. Essentially, it's what it's doing is it's amplifying any small signal, creating a copy of that, and amplifying that to the point where the inventor, Kerry Mullis, which strangely died in 2019, very critical of Anthony Fauci, by the way, but the inventor of it said, look, we're misusing the PCR test. It's, you know, you can find anything within anything with a PCR test when you use it improperly, when you calibrate it improperly. So, and they calibrated it improperly. A PCR test, how many times you amplify that little marker that you're looking for, that little, fragment of DNA that you're looking for, how many times you amplify it can be abused to the point that you'll find, you know, a COVID-19 positive PCR test in a guava fruit or a tennis shoe, and believe it or not, or a goat. And believe it or not, the president of Tasmania did that. He actually did PCR testing. He had the same belief, there's something wrong here. So he collected PCR samples of a guava fruit, a tennis shoe, and a goat, and he sent it into the laboratory and they all came back positive. So that the Kerry Mullis said the same thing. If you misuse this test, you can find anything within anything. And that's the way, and we were calibrating it at 40 plus cycle threshold, meaning 40 amplifications. And it's like, you know, you start with one amplification, you go from one to two pieces of that matching fragment. You go from two to four and four to 16, and exponentially like that 40 times, you're in the trillions of molecules being amplified. So you can literally find anything, that little segment and anything when you amplify it, that you create a noisy signal that makes everything look positive. That was the perfect abuse of the technology to create a case-demic in the early, you know, to make everything look worse than what it was, so that we thought we were just, you know, exploding with COVID all over the planet at an extraordinary rate. Many of those cases were not disease. And the other thing that I would say is we got to the point where we were mislabeling, you know, disease. You can have the virus and not have the disease. You can have a fragment of that virus. You could have had an infection that was mild, cleared, and weeks later, you're still positive for it. And they would, of course, call that a positive COVID test. But it was a intentionally misused and abused test that was over-amplified to the point where it's rare that you would ever see a negative PCR test.
Mm-hmm. You know, what caught my attention is early on, my best friend had metastatic breast cancer, we found out. And at this point, her husband needed extra care, and he took her to the hospital. They tested her for with the PCR test, COVID, right? Yeah. And it was positive. So they put her on the COVID floor.
Right.
And they continue to test her, and it would be positive, negative, positive, yeah, negative. And I'm thinking, I'm no doctor, I'm no nurse, but I'm thinking, if my diagnostic test keeps coming back differently every time I test,
yes,
there has to be, yeah, something wrong with the test.
It's a bad test. It was a bad test, and it was, you know, but it was, that's a perfect example. Somebody comes in that they don't have COVID in their body. They might have a positive, you know, the false positive rate was like 98%. When it's amplified 40 plus cycle thresholds. And that was mandated, by the way, the laboratories had to run it at that extraordinary, you know, number of amplifications when, you know, prior to COVID, to give you an example, have PCR testing should be properly done. When you run a PCR test for disease, you want to have a report of how many amplifications they did. That's called cycle threshold. So I know that if somebody is positive with a PCR test after, like, say, 17 to 20 cycle thresholds, that means it didn't take many amplifications to find that little marker, that segment, that fragment of the virus was present in the patient's body. So that tells me that, you know, at 17 cycle thresholds, yeah, they probably have the virus, and it's at a pretty high level because it didn't take many amplifications for us to start measuring that in a observable fashion. But if it takes, you know, 30 plus cycle thresholds or 30 plus amplifications before you see it, you don't know whether you have an infection or just some little residual fragment. And when you do 40 plus, it's meaningless. That you've just rendered the test meaningless. Now, they also, the FDA was telling laboratories not to report the cycle threshold. When I would call a laboratory and say, okay, you gave me a positive PCR test, but you didn't report the cycle threshold, I can't read that without that important information. They say, we can't report it. And when I would ask them, well, yeah, you can, and you have to, I'm asking, so tell me, they would say, well, it was 40 plus cycle thresholds. And they know that that is an irrelevant test, but they were told that they had to do that. So to get that COVID PCR testing, they signed some documentation that really, you know, makes me believe that there was an intent to abuse that test, to kind of withhold from doctors and the public the fact that we're not really giving you the whole story here, and we've created a test that we're going to run to the point of abuse so it gives you lots of cases. And that served the narrative because they wanted to fearmonger the population into believing that this was the most infectious, toxic disease in the history of the world. We got a lockdown, hide in our basements, wear two masks, and, you know, just obey, comply, right, or, you know, humanity is at risk. And yeah, they accomplished that in the minds of many people. They accomplished that.
They did.
For those of us that were kind of watching what was going on, we're going, this thing has run off the rails. Mm-hmm. What is going on here? You know, that was some of the early signs that we weren't doing scientific methods here. We were doing something else, but it right. wasn't science.
Hey, I'm going to get to that thought in just a second, but right now I'm going to take a quick break.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and I want to thank each and every one of you for your support by bringing you the pillow that started it all. Get my standard My Pillow, regularly $49.98, now only $19.98 with your promo code. Just like all of you, I've tried every pillow out there and none of them worked. That's why I invented My Pillow. My patented fill adjusts your exact individual needs, helps keep your neck aligned, and it holds its shape all night long, regardless of your sleep position, so you get the best sleep of your life. Because it works, we've sold over 70 million MyPillows, and now I'm bringing them to you for the lowest price ever. Go to MyPillow.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code, and you'll get my standard MyPillow for only $19.98. For a more custom fit, my premium queen for only $27.98. Or my premium king, only $34.98. My 60-day money-back guarantees it'll be the most comfortable pillow you'll ever own.
Hey, everybody, this is Kash Patel, and you're watching The Amber May Show.
These days, it's hard finding doctors you can trust, but look no further, because now you can go to Dr. Meehan at MeehanMD.com for all your future healthcare needs. And while you're there, you might want to check out his supplements. He has some amazing supplements. For instance, the Optimal Defense, that is perfect for the cold and flu time of year. That helps support your immune system. And if you have like reoccurring issues that come up with your health, that might be a great supplement for you to try. You may also want to check out Immune Plus. It has herbs like echinacea and elderberry. And Immune Plus also contains medicinal mushrooms to help support the body's natural defenses. So if you're looking for a doctor you can trust, set up a telemed appointment with Dr. Meehan at MeehanMD.com. Use promo code AMBER while you're there. Again, Meehan is spelled MeehanMD.com for all your telemed and supplemental needs. And remember, use promo code AMBER at checkout.
You are listening to The Amber May Show, and now we return to the show already in progress.
No. One size. And now, with those PCR tests, is it really COVID, or could it have been anything? Could they have been, sick with any?
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Carrie, so it wasn't again, the inventor just for the virus. Could have been anything. I could have had the flu. I could have had.
You could have had the flu. Yeah.
I could have had it. Okay.
Many of the cases had to be, you know, they had to be the flu. The flu didn't disappear. Influenza didn't disappear. But they, you know, they created a system where, you know, even if you weren't PCR positive, if you had never seen the virus in your body or anything like the virus ever, you had a very good chance that you're going to be PCR positive anyway. But they also create an incentive when you go to the hospitals and they got $13,000 bonus dollars in addition to everything that they would normally charge you, that they would take like your friend who probably didn't have any evidence of the virus, any possibility of the virus. But now you enter a hospital where it's everywhere because it's an aerosolized virus. You can't control an aerosolized virus. And when you got a floor full of them, you know, I mean, it's a weaponized virus. Let's not, you know, deny the fact that they created a bioengineered bioweapon with a furin cleavage domain inserted into it. And it was weaponization and gain of function of a virus that was intended to kill a large portion of the population. And it was unleashed upon the world. And so it's a very, you know, transmissible and especially the early versions of that bioweapon, they were very dangerous and difficult if you didn't get, you know, early treatment to block that virus's effects. But it aerosolizes. And when a virus aerosolizes, it can hang in the air for hours. Your mask won't stop it. It won't prevent it. In fact, masks will increase aerosolized viruses in the population. So masks were another lie that were, you know, the science said wouldn't work, but they did it anyway. And what I believe
is, Dr. Meehan, I was standing 6 feet apart with my mask. So then I am safe.
In a room full of aerosolized viral particles, infectious viral particles that can hang there for hours and drift, you know, long distances. And so, you know, 6 feet apart was, again, more nonsense based on a child's science project. And it had no basis in science whatsoever, but it, you know, there was something else behind that 6 feet of distancing. It probably had more to do with mass surveillance and the ability to identify, you know, when people are 6 feet apart, you can resolve them and tell that there are two people 6 feet apart. When they're too close together, you know, you can't mass surveil that kind of a population. True. So I think it had to do more with mass surveillance and the limitations of the technology at the time. But it wasn't about, you know, inhibiting a respiratory disease process. But I want to say one other thing about the mask, because, you know, I wrote a book. Everybody can go to MeehanMD.com and download a free ebook on why masks are unnecessary, ineffective, and harmful. One of the harms that a lot of people I don't see discussed enough is a principle on how masks can increase aerosolization of these aerosolizable viruses. How they can take your respiratory droplets that would normally, you know, if you have influenza or SARS, it's replicating and it's in your mucosa and you're coughing and breathing it out. most of that will be trapped in large respiratory droplets that fall to the ground within 3 feet and are neutralized. But now when you put a mask on, a cloth or even a surgical mask, you capture the large respiratory particles, and the force of your breath and the heat of your breath starts to dehydrate and shrink down those large droplets into smaller and smaller and ultimately aerosolizable, you know, less than 5 nanometer, tiny, tiny particles, like the old, you know, people say mosquitoes flying through a chain link fence. Yeah. So you get them to such a small level that now they're, you took a something that would have been neutralized in a large droplet, you've converted it into a small aerosolizable droplet. And in effect, a mask can become a mister of aerosolized particles. You can just.
And why did they use them in surgery? Because it's my understanding they're doing it as a preventative, or like your dentist, because your mouth is open. That
right.
If you sneeze, you accidentally sneeze, it'll protect you. Is that still true? Is that true?
No,
that
it's not. We don't wear them in surgery. And we've known this, that meta-analysis of the wearing a mask in surgery is not to prevent wound infections in our surgical patients. I'm a surgeon. I did 10,000 surgeries. I studied this pretty intently long before the pandemic, because there's been a long standing debate. Do masks, you know, are masks necessary for the surgical operating suite? And the answer is no, they don't prevent wound infections. That's been multiple randomized controlled trials, meta-analyzed by the Cochrane Collaboration in 2012 and 2014, said masks are not preventing wound infections. We wear them primarily out of tradition. I would say that's number one. Number two is in, you know, wet surgeries where, you know, like a orthopedist doing a bone saw procedure, or cardiovascular surgeon, where there might be the chance of body fluid spraying into the face of the surgeon. Okay. They're more to protect from that than they are anything else. They are not a good source of what they call source control. So they're not protecting my patient from getting something from me. I mean, any surgeon that would do surgery while infected is, you know, is, I would call it medical negligence. You know, if you're not feeling at your best, you better not be doing surgery. If you think you have a transmissible disease, you better not be doing surgery thinking a mask is going to protect you. That's not why we wear them. We wear them because many times that's what the hospital requires. It's kind of tradition. Your patients, you know, patients aren't aware of all this background science that says they don't, you know, do anything to prevent wound infections. They inhibit the performance of surgeons. When you wear a mask for longer than about 30 minutes, even in that optimal environment of a surgical suite where it's, you know, good airflow, lower temperatures, you know, more oxygen in the air, it still can decrease your hand-eye coordination. You can develop a tremor if the, you know, CO2 retention and rebreathing your own exhalations, that would always affect me. I was a microsurgeon, an eye surgeon, and I would work under the microscope. And if my mask got, you know, too wet, I wore it too long, I would have to change masks every 30 minutes to prevent that tremor from starting to develop at that microscopic level. So now I'm very, you know, that's why as I started listening to, well, you know, the big clue was when Fauci and the Surgeon General both flipped within 30 days. First, they said masks won't, you know, won't help. They won't stop the virus from spreading, because that was what the science, 100 years of science had told us that. But then 30 days later, Fauci changed his tune. The World Health Organization changed their tune. Deborah Cohen, a renowned British journalist, actually started asking the question, why did you change your position on masks in World Health Organization? And the answer she got was because of lobbying. They were lobbied to change their position.
I remember Dr. Fauci getting an email from China telling him to start doing the mask thing. And that's when things started changing. And when he started changing his tune about masks, and I'm like, could that have been why?
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I think that too much of our government right now is taking orders from China. I think they're the puppet masters for our current administration. I think that's a real issue. In fact, much of the pandemic, you know, we were mirroring China was I think they were, you know, they were delivering misinformation telling us this is how we handled it, and you should do it that way too. Fauci said as much. That, you know, Fauci and so many of our public health leaders were admiring China's handling of the pandemic, never considering that they were absolutely lying about their case rates and everything else. And we were, in fact, just following probably, you know, a plan. It was probably a strategic plan to mislead us into mishandling much of the pandemic, even to the point of, you know, I've heard this from reliable sources, but I'm pretty sure the Chinese military was not vaccinated like our military troops were.
Oh, I'm pretty sure you're right. So let's go back. So we know all this stuff happened, and the American people started getting wise. And for the first time in my life, Dr. Meehan, I began not trusting physicians.
Yeah.
I always trusted them explicitly. And maybe that was bad of me to do so.
No, it was just late. You should have probably done it a long time ago.
I should have because, you know, I would talk to the doctor about when I had my babies and I had infertility. And I'm thinking how to do with the tetanus shot I got in my early 20s based on the documentary I saw. But I would go to my pediatrician and I said, are these safe? I'm hearing they cause autism. And he's like, oh, no, that's be debunked. And find out, yeah, the CDC lied to all the doctors. So, like, I trusted all of our doctors until COVID. And now I'm very selective. Thank God for the Reawaken Tour, because I've met so many amazing physicians that I feel like I can go to now if I need something. Unfortunately, you guys are all in another state, but that's okay. I tell them that, so that's fine.
Yeah, that's right.
But tell me, what is it like in medical school? I want to know about that stuff.
Yeah. So, what I often say is that from the first day of medical school to the last day of your practice, you are being indoctrinated and brainwashed by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I was older when I went to medical school. I'd been a cadet at the United States Military Academy at West Point. I'd run a family business. So I go into medical school having some real world experience. Most of my classmates came, you know, right out of college into medical school, and they're just heads full of mush, you know, ready to be formed by the process. And that process was really controlled by and created by the Rockefellers back in the 1960s and 70s. They transformed medicine in America into a business model to sell and push pharmaceuticals. So in medical school, I was very frustrated. You know, 70% of our professors were sitting on the boards of pharma companies. The textbooks are funded by Pfizer. You know, the classrooms, the scholarships, all funded by pharma. The chairs are in, you know, the tenured chairs are endowed by pharmaceutical companies. The entire process is all about pharma. You know, you mentioned the childhood vaccines, pediatricians. You know, we get a couple of hours and hundreds of hours. We get a couple of hours studying childhood vaccines, and all it is studying, memorizing the CDC recommended childhood schedule and how to catch a child up that didn't, you know, that fell behind or something, and getting their nothing about the polysorbate 80, the neurotoxic aluminum adjuvants that are added to them, the history of thimerosal and the mercury preservatives used in childhood vaccines, nothing about the various ingredients, you know, Chinese hamster ovary cells, certainly nothing which I found very
fetal tissue cells.
Exactly. Yeah. Something that, as a follower of Christ, as a Christian, that I found absolutely abhorrent, that I had never been taught about how the live virus vaccines are grown on these human cells that were, you know, taken from a child that was sacrificed. I like to use the proper words. It's sacrifice. Mm-hmm. They sacrifice this child at the moment of its entrance into the world, mm-hmm. capture it in a saline bag, take it to the vivisection table, rip it apart without any anesthesia, you know, trying to harvest those infected tissues that have the rubella virus or the chickenpox virus, the adenovirus or the measles virus. So they're literally harvesting these children's, these newborn children brought into the world at ages, many of which they could have lived, and their sacrifice and their tissues harvested so they could endlessly become the manufacturing substrate for these live virus vaccines. And certainly nothing to the effect of, for example, you know, the chickenpox vaccine has twice as much human antigen from those aborted fetal cells as it does the varicella, the chickenpox antigen, twice as much.
And you know what, Dr. Meehan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you, I don't want to lose this thought, but
yeah,
people are thinking because of the human antigen that's in some of these shots.
Yeah.
There's a hypothesis out there thinking that that might be what is also, besides the indoctrination on the TV, confusing people about their gender.
Hey, I'm going to get to that thought in just a second, but right now I'm going to take a quick break.
So, do you like to start your day off with a cup of coffee? What if I told you you could get a cup of coffee that not only helps rejuvenate your mind, get you going in the morning, but it could reduce stress? What would you say? Well, I have just the solution for you. I have the Java Boost right here. It's delicious. It's the most creamy, delicious vanilla coffee that is infused with antioxidants from muscadine, ginger, and turmeric. It eliminates cravings, it helps support healthy blood chemistry, and it promotes healthy weight loss. When have you ever heard of a coffee that helps promote healthy weight loss? So if you want a coffee that's delicious, creamy, vanilla, helps reduce stress and fatigue, and helps promote healthy weight loss, then you want to grab Java Boost for yourself. And the easiest way to do that is going to cupahealth.com. That's cupahealth.com. Use promo code Amber May at checkout.
This is Charlie Ward. Welcome to the Amber May TV show.
Government-induced inflation, taxes, rising interest rates, all of these can have a dramatic effect on our investments. So why not buy some gold and silver? Gold and silver throughout history has been a stabilizer in people's portfolio. Protect your wealth, protect your assets by purchasing gold and silver. The easiest way to do that is contacting Jim, who you've seen on our program, Jim Tewalt, with EPS Wealth Management. That's Edward Paul Sam, EPSWealthManagement.com. There you can go ahead and contact him and say, hey, I would love to get my hands on some gold and silver, especially with the electronic currency that is looming on our horizon. So if they go to a total digital currency, it might be wise to have some tangible assets in your portfolio for trading, because you never know when they might cut off your income stream. So go to EPS, Edward Paul Sam, EPSWealthManagement.com. Ask for Jim Tewalt to make sure you have some gold and silver in your portfolio. Let him know Amber May sent you.
You are listening to The Amber May Show, and now we return to the show already in progress.
I don't know if there's anything
it's
to
possible.
It.
I mean, yeah, it's not impossible. So, you know, Teresa Deicher is a scientist that first, Dr. Deicher first identified adult stem cells. And she's the founding director of Sound Choice Pharmaceuticals right now, trying to
it's the year find alternative 2023
sources other than human
and the warrior women of God have been preparing for this day for generations.
But Dr. Deicher identified that these
and have walked through DNA microfracture to be ready for such a time, you know, as
the
this.
Varicella vaccine, for
the
example,
God of all gods, the king of the universe,
and the live
chose
virus
them
in
from
general.
Birth.
When
they are growing, he destined their very DNA for such a time
lines.
As this. No one could have known when these women were little girls.
You know,
they would be called to battle on the front lines
kind of
during a biblical war of good versus evil,
than they do on
except God.
So
he,
they, when they're, when the
for
virus
he has been preparing you for such a time
cell,
as this.
This, you know, this slurry,
we
this
have
blood,
been called to intercede. Pray,
human,
activate, and be
DNA,
the warrior bride that God made us to be. Is that you? Esther was called for such a time as this. She was chosen to go before the king, prepare his heart, and save her people. Join us at the first ever Esther's Rising event in Branson, Missouri. You will learn from extraordinary women who are fighting on the front lines of the battlefield. You will leave activated, prayed for and given tools to step out and be the Esther you were created to be. Join us at the God and Country Theater in beautiful Branson, Missouri, March 4th, 2023. Who knows if you haven't been brought into the kingdom for such a time as this. Register now for Esther's Rising at www.tanyajoy.tv/Esther. And join us in Branson, Missouri on March 4th, 2023 at the God and Country Theater.
It picks up that code, and that could do any number of things. More concerning than its potential for changing, gender, I'm more concerned about what was found in Italy at the Corvelva Institute. So a group in Italy took the childhood vaccines, took them for genetic analysis to identify all the genetic strands and sequences that were in the vaccine. And they found that there were lots of things in the vaccines that were not listed on the ingredients list, like flatworm DNA. But one of the most concerning things that they found was that there were about 540 tumor genes that had appeared that were present in the DNA sequences that were found in these vaccines. And I think the standing hypothesis is that many of these childhood vaccines that are grown on these human aborted fetal cells that were harvested sometime in the 1960s and 70s, they have been replicating endlessly for 60 plus years, right? So we thought that they would be immortal, that they would just replicate, create perfect copies of themselves over and over and over. But like all cells, there's the potential for mutations. And some of those mutations can create tumorigenic genes. That happens in our own body. But when you have a situation, it's like if you take a picture on a piece of paper and you make a copy of it, and then you take that copy and you make a copy of it, and then you take that copy and make a copy of it, and you just keep copying over and over, several generations of that copying of that original picture, you create something that's almost indistinguishable from the original because of the inherent loss of granularity of that image. And when you are replicating a cell over a long period of time, you're going to get mutations. And so the potential here is that we are injecting a 540 some odd tumor genes into our children's body with every one of these live virus vaccines. They have, they have been endlessly replicating in a laboratory, and nobody seems to be checking as to whether tumor genes are starting to arise. So you've got multiple mechanisms where that whole system just goes awry.
You made a good point. I was looking for my FDA package insert because 13.1, over and over again, they say they don't test for cancer. Right. They don't test to see if it changes your genes in any kind of way. And they don't test to see if it causes infertility. So right. I know two kids who have gotten childhood vaccines or childhood cancers. Yeah. And I'm going to, and one of them is also was autistic. One of them died. Mm-hmm. One of them, right, to my knowledge, is still alive. So there's such a high rate of cancer. And I think that even grownups go back and get the flu shot. They go get the tetanus. They go get all kinds of shots, right? Even grownups do. I think there's a component to where we're probably giving ourselves cancer by these vaccines.
I mean, it's the potential is absolutely there. And the fact of the matter is, if people understood, and that's why, one of the benefits that I have is that I was a medical editor of a medical journal. I know how to read the science. I know how to discern, fact from fiction, fraud from, real high level good science. The medical literature is filled with fraudulent, corrupt pseudoscience that was just bought and paid for. In fact, early in my career as a medical editor, I had, two studies that I thought absolutely should have been published in our journal. There's the Journal of Ocular Inflammation and Immunology. And they were denied publication. When I called a meeting with the senior editor to find out what I had missed, he said, "You didn't miss anything, Jim. You just don't know how the game is played." And he went on to say, "Merck is a major donor to this university, Washington University in St. Louis. If we publish these two studies that were casting doubt on the MMR vaccine delivered at 12 months and the onset of vasculitis and retinal hemorrhages in children and toddlers, that if we publish that study, Merck would come after you. Would lose your job. I'd lose my job. This journal would probably cease to be.
So it's better to injure a baby than for you to lose, not you specifically, but for an adult to lose their job, it's better to injure a child than that. I mean, where's the morality there? I mean,
there is no morality in that. Yeah. Amber, you know, you have to understand medicine is full of atheists, probably a lot of Satanists, you know, people that either don't recognize God or they think they are gods. I mean, you see a lot of that, the God complex, and medicine is, and the egomaniacism. There's a lot of psychopathology among your medical professionals. It's why they're one of the highest rates of suicide in all professions. Recognize it. There's a lot of psychopathology in medical doctors. I saw it early, and I'm embarrassed by my profession.
I don't know what that means about how that affects the eyes. I know that happens with shaken baby. Does that mean that the baby's going to go blind, or is that brain trauma? Like, can you explain that to me about the eye thing?
I would love to. Okay. Yeah. I love talking about that because that was the point. So there were two studies that came across my desk in the early 2000s, and one from Europe, one from the West Coast of the United States, completely independent research institutions. We're finding a very strong association of retinal bleeding in the back of a child's eye that is typically considered the cardinal sign of shaken baby syndrome. So the premise being that in shaken baby syndrome, they have they have hemorrhages in the brain, they have hemorrhages in the retina, and that it was caused by some parent or guardian or somebody shaking a baby so vigorously that they're causing, you know, trauma and shearing of the tissue, shearing of the vasculature in the back of the eye, and that causes the bleeding. Well, you know, a lot of studies have shown that you cannot, you know, you can't physically shake a child hard enough to cause that kind of problem without it leaving some other. So you can shake a child or throw a child down. It can cause that kind of trauma, but there's always external, you know, signals, broken bones, bruising, you know, soft tissue damage in the neck. I had seen two dozen of these children in the ER, spoken to the parents and on a full physical exam. They would call me down as a young ophthalmologist at the time to dilate the eyes. And if I identified these retinal hemorrhages, then that was shaken baby syndrome. That's dogma. That's considered settled science and dogma in medicine. And so I'd been there, you know, probably about a dozen times before I had seen these studies, and I was perplexed. I was like, I don't understand. You know, if I diagnose retinal hemorrhages, this is DHS intervening, taking this child, parents traumatized. It's just destroying a family. Right. And I can't find any of the other, you know, soft tissue injuries, bony injuries. I look at the x-rays, I look at the CTs, and none of it is mad. There's no, I mean, you're going to have bruising. They're going to be bruised in the shape of hands if this is really occurring, right? And you're not seeing any of it. So when these two studies came across my desk, I did all of the stuff that a good medical editor does. I looked for conflicts of interest, who funded the study, how many, you know, was it a large enough population? Did they use the right statistical analysis? I looked for all of the, you know, I had a checklist of about 100 things that I would look for before approving it. I had done that with thousands of journal articles and never had any denied, you know, refused, you know, I separated the wheat from the chaff, as they say. So I turned down a lot, but this is the first time I'd had any denied. And I didn't know what the reason, they should not have been denied. And for one reason, if no other reason, was it was really compelling, solid science performed that went against the dogma that we're taught that's a very strong, if not the indicator for child abuse and shaken baby syndrome. And so I, you know, it was an argument that needed to be had. It was a debate that needed to be had. And my medical editor refused to, you know, refused because he didn't want to lose his job.
So what is that? What happens with the retinal bleeding to the child? Like, can they not see anymore, or what happens?
Yeah, it really depends. That can often heal. So that kind of retinal vasculitis that begins because, and it's an inflammatory process. So these two studies were saying we have identified an inflammatory vasculitis that we think is related to the battery of vaccines that a child receives at 12 months of age. And by the way, this is the first time that the child receives the MMR vaccine. This is a time when MMR was really under scrutiny because there were a lot of parents reporting that their child was fine until they got the MMR vaccine. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, that's when the CDC decided to literally throw away or shred the evidence that MMR and autism go hand in hand.
That's exactly right, Amber. And that, so I didn't know that that was all happening at the same time that the CDC was deep in the swamp of fabric, you know, destroying data, trying to retell, manipulate the data to publish that 2004 Pediatrics Journal article that purported to say, the MMR vaccine is not associated with an increase in autism, when 10 years later in 2014, William Thompson came forward and admitted out of his guilt and shame that they found a significant increase. He helped Brian Hooker to find the data that they gathered in a room. So William Thompson said they gathered us in a room with a big trash can in the middle, and they told us to destroy our data. And he didn't, because he knew that was illegal. He retained all of his data and all of his documentation. And then 10 years later, as he says in his legal statement from his attorney, out of his guilt and as he also says in the audio recordings that Brian Hooker collected, out of his guilt and shame, they lied and manipulated to tell a story that was not true. They did not want the public to know, that the medical establishment to know, that the MMR vaccine was associated with a 700% increase in autism in previously healthy children with no underlying factors, 340% increase prevalence of autism in African-American boys. It was a, you know, 270% increase in autism in African-American children in general. So that was such a dangerous, inconvenient truth that this large randomized controlled trial had exposed, that they had to kill it. They had to suppress it. And so they used some, you know, they defied the study design methodology, which is you don't do that in medicine. You set out the study design and you adhere to it, because the study design is designed to help you, to keep you from doing things to create the outcome that you want. But they defied it. They changed the rules and they dropped a bunch of kids from the data so they could, you know, wash away and scrub clean the evidence that the MMR vaccine was causing autism. So if any of your viewers, listeners have not seen Vaxxed from Cover Up to Catastrophe, you have to watch it. You absolutely have to watch it, because our government, our CDC, you know, under Julie Gerberding, director of the CDC at that time, and this cast of characters, Boyle and you know, the rest of the cat, what's the other guy's name, the main guy there? I mean, there's just a bad actors in the CDC that lied, destroyed documents, tried to cover up the evidence of the MMR vaccine's assault on the health and the immune system of children. But that's what these studies were also pointing to, was that this MMR vaccine was the probable cause, when you control for everything else and you regression analysis and all this thing, the statistical analysis you do, it's probably the MMR vaccine that was causing this inflammation of the blood vessels that we could see in the eye because of the retinal vasculature. You can see through the opening in the eye and the pupil, so that you could see that. You can see that if it's happening in the eye, it's happening every place else in the body, and the brain included. And I think it's, you know, I think that is, more often than not, it is probably a vasculitis induced by the, you know, a cytokine explosion caused by the vaccines and susceptible children, probably maybe not all children, but susceptible children. And that could cause an encephalopathy, a brain inflammation.
I think
many cases of autism are, you know, vaccine induced encephalopathies. They're vaccine brain injuries. And we don't want to admit it. They try to tell you that, you know, it's better diagnosis of autism. Nonsense. In fact, J.B. Hanley's book, How to End the Autism Epidemic, does an excellent refutation and debunking of that nonsense that it's better diagnosis. It's not better diagnosis, ladies and gentlemen. Our children are, especially American children, they're being harmed by a childhood vaccine program that is immune to liability. They don't use placebo controls. They the longest vaccine study, preclinical trial vaccine study in all the childhood vaccines is 42 days. It was 42 days was the MMR vaccine. You got many vaccines like the hepatitis B vaccine that was only followed for 5 days in 147 children.
For five days.
For 5 days, yeah.
American people are under the assumption, because we're indoctrinated even school, because I remember hearing about the FDA and the CDC and all that in school,
right?
That it's thoroughly tested. And then I'm finding out on my own, it's not thoroughly tested. And there's three major things they don't even test for. Three major things. And I'm thinking, if they don't test for these three major things, what else are they not testing for?
Yeah. Well, they're not. And when you follow a child for only 5 days, you're not testing for hundreds of things that, you know, the autoimmune disease isn't going to manifest for sometimes many years. And that's what a lot of the vaccines are really, that's my area of expertise is immunology, infectious disease, and inflammation. And vaccines are inducing a very significant dysregulation of the immune system. But the biggest thing for me was, as a physician scientist and someone that, you know, trained in science before medical school, I was appalled that we were not applying gold standard, rigorous, randomized controlled trials using placebos and large population of patients that were followed for a long period of time. That's the way we do science. The way the tobacco industry did science is the way the vaccine industry is doing science. In fact, vaccine science is tobacco science 2.0. It's just better, but, you know, more deceptive. And they're using the same kind of argument. So when they say it's, you know, well-tested, what they're referring to is observational studies on populations like the Danish population, where they don't get anywhere near the same kind of vaccines. But observational studies can, I can make you believe that, you know, carrots cause COVID with an observational study. I can make you think masks work by controlling and, you know, the lots of different, I can confound a study to make you believe anything when it's an observational study. And that's what they're doing. And that's the way the tobacco industry did it too. They said, hey, you know, for 40 years, they told us that cigarettes are not addictive and they don't cause cancer. Cause if they did, we would know. There's billions of people smoking cigarettes and we would know if it caused cancer, right? That's what, that's the same argument that they're, when they say they're thoroughly tested, they're talking about, we give these vaccines to billions of kids and we don't see a problem. They don't,
of course, because they don't want to see the problem.
They don't want to see the problem. And there's so many reasons for that. They created the vaccine adverse event reporting system, which is horribly broken. And yet, you know, and in fact, it was studied and shown by Harvard Pilgrim that it captures probably about 1% of all vaccine injuries, childhood vaccine injuries. So they created a system that doctors are legally supposed to report to, but they don't because it's hard to use. I think more to the point, though, is you got a bunch of pediatricians that are, and doctors in general, brainwashed and indoctrinated by that mantra that vaccines are safe and effective. Vaccines do not cause autism. Vaccines are a miracle of modern medicine. Mm-hmm. Those are mantras.
That they eradicate disease. That's what everyone's told. And that's what doctors tell you too. They eradicate disease. So if we get rid of vaccines.
Say that enough and you hear that enough.
Yes.
You know, that's how you brainwash people. Furthermore, if you believe that there was this horrible doctor by the name of Andrew Wakefield that, you know, created some kind of a horrible study. I mean, which is nonsense. Andrew Wakefield did a 12-patient cohort study that showed an association between the MMR vaccine and autism. But he didn't even say, all he said was more science needs to be done, but they had to vilify him because he was one of the first real physician, you know, courageous, high integrity physician scientists that did a case cohort study and said, look, we may have a problem here. Let's study it some more. But instead of studying it, they had to destroy him. So they taught the medical establishment to fear stepping out of line. If you step out of line, you will be wakefielded. If you believe something other than vaccines are safe and effective, vaccines do not cause autism, then we will destroy you. And that's, you know, that's what they've done. So a lot of doctors, even during the COVID pandemic, they wouldn't have gotten that vaccine for the life of them. They saw it harming people. They saw it early. They saw the science that says we didn't even test it for preventing infection or transmission. I'm sorry, but ladies and gentlemen, that was in the original preclinical trials. If you know how to read science and medicine, it's there clear as day. You know, from the earliest stages of this pandemic, I could have told you that we don't know whether this is going to block infection or transmission because it wasn't studied in the preclinical trials.
It's the year 2023, and the warrior women of God have been preparing for this day for generations. And have walked through deep valleys to be ready for such a time as this. The God of all gods, the King of the universe, chose them from birth. He destined their very DNA for such a time as this. No one could have known when these women were little girls, they would be called to battle on the front lines during a biblical war of good versus evil. Except God. He knew. For He has been preparing you for such a time as this. We have been called to intercede, pray, activate, and be the warrior bride that God made us to be. Is that you? Esther was called for such a time as this. She was chosen to go before the king, prepare his heart, and save her people. Join us at the first ever Esther's Rising event in Branson, Missouri. You will learn from extraordinary women who are fighting on the front lines of the battlefield. You will leave activated, prayed for, and given tools to step out and be the Esther you were created to be. Join us at the God and Country Theater in beautiful Branson, Missouri, March 4th, 2023. Who knows if you haven't been brought into the kingdom for such a time as this. Register now for Esther's Rising at www.tanyajoy.tv/Esther. And join us in Branson, Missouri on March 4th, 2023 at the God and Country Theater.